everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. I'm your host Red Sail, and coming up today, while the judges discuss the novels on this year's Silip Carnegie shortlist, we've got the second of our shows featuring their authors. Geraldine McCorcoran takes us to a remote Scottish sea stack, the setting for Where the World Ends.
And it has all of that appeal of an island where, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful to live that remotely?
Will Hill sifts through the embers after a religious cult comes to an apocalyptic end in After the Fire.
This just brought this one particularly back to me, and I started thinking that there was a story there that I might want to tell.
And last year's winner, Ruta Sepetys, reveals the real-life events that inspired her to write Salt to the Sea.
Many of the people that I'm writing about believe that the world has forgotten them, or that these pieces of history have slipped through the cracks.
That's all coming up in today's Read On. Geraldine McCorcoran is a British writer with an international reputation. She's written more than 160 books and been translated into 45 languages. Many of her works are adaptations for children of classic stories, such as Gilgamesh, The Odyssey, The Canterbury Tales, and 1001 Arabian Nights. Her latest novel, Where the World Ends, transports the reader back to 1727 and a remote Scottish sea stack, upon which a small group of boys and men have seemingly been abandoned. Geraldine McCorcoran, welcome to Read On.
Thank you.
So, can you tell us a little bit more about Where the World Ends?
It's an idea that I got from, well, initially I read Judith Schalansky's beautiful Atlas of Remote Islands. And it's a non-fiction book that is just full of stories, real-life stories. Then my daughter went off on a surprise visit to St Kilda and came back so full of the place, so full of its anecdotes and its actual history, she intrigued me just as much as she'd been intrigued. So, I knew of the place. Obviously, everybody knows of St Kilda. It's one of those kind of dream islands, so remote that people barely believe that anyone could have lived there. And it has all of that appeal of an island where, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful to live that remotely? Wouldn't it be splendid to be so self-sufficient and not have to go out and earn a living except just to gather your food and raise your crop? And also, it has that frisson of, what would it be like to be marooned entirely on your own, miles from anywhere, no contact with the mainland, except perhaps twice, three times a year, no help if there's a disaster. So the two elements, as with any island, it just begs to have a book written about it. And there have been lots of books about St Kilda, lots of adult non-fiction books, but no children's books.
Certainly, I've read one in the past about the Guga hunters, the fowlers who go out and collect birds and bird eggs, but it was very much an adult book, and I was intrigued to see how you would handle it and make it accessible for children whilst not being grim. And then I read at the end that this is actually based on a true story, that these boys and men were marooned on the sea stack in the early 1700s.
That's right, yes, they were. Of course, the author in me just thought, what did they think while they were there? What sense did they make of it? Imagine that you're sent out to gather birds, as boys are every summer. A couple of men and a bunch of boys go out there to reap the fantastic harvest of baby googas and the other birds for feathers and oil and meat. Which is great. It's almost like a holiday away from your parents and you're on your own and you're doing what you're best at. And then nobody comes to get you. And you wait around and still nobody comes. And I thought, well, what went through their minds? What did they think might have happened? And one of the conclusions I came to was that they would assume that the world had come to an end and that they'd been left behind by the angels in the rapture because they were not where they'd be expected to be, not where anybody would be expected to be, on a rock sticking up out of the sea. But, of course, the summer dies and the autumn comes and it starts to be winter, and it's a ghastly, horrendous place to be stuck without any expectation of being rescued, because clearly the world at large has forgotten about you.
And it's very much about the power of stories to keep up morale, to explain, and actually to control the very small population that is living on the island, how storytelling is used as part of human existence.
Yes, that's right. And I put it in the hands of a child who is the one that knows the most stories and cares most about stories. So the adults aren't coping at all well, but Quilliam, tells stories to try and stop the boys panicking and to try and make them less homesick and to try and make them laugh and just as you say, keep morale up. I always like stories within the story, so it appeals very much to an author to have a character in the story that tells stories.
Is the implication then maybe that adults have lost the power of imagination and it is only the children represented by Quilliam who can still take a flight of fancy to a better place?
Perhaps. Although they can't do it, Quill's the only one among them that can do it. I like to think that all children can take flights of fantasy to places, but I would venture that most of them are the readers. Those that read books, a lot of children I come across don't really grasp the concept of escaping into the imagination. Personally, I've always had an interior imaginary world where I can go when I'm fed up. And I think it's one of the great joys of childhood, it was when I was a child, and of reading, is that it gives you the capacity to create your own interior world, and where no one can hurt you, nobody, and everybody loves you, and you're everything that you want to be. So I'm quite in favour of encouraging children to use their interior world, their imagination, to create themselves a happy place.
You're well known for taking the myths and legends and classic stories that we have all got in common and translating those into a more child and young adult friendly form. Do you see that as a sort of continuum in storytelling, that we are always making variations on a theme with our stories?
Absolutely, yes. I think there's no point in telling new stories unless you're going to tell the old one, when there's perfectly good old ones around that need retelling if they're not to become extinct. I love retelling the myths, and they are mostly because they date back to a time when stories were for everybody and not just for adults or children. They handle the big things that matter to you, whatever age you are, about death and violence and fear and monsters and what we're here for, all the big stuff. I love doing this, and I reckon Gilgamesh, which is the oldest story in the world, is one of my favourites. So I don't feel any compunction in retelling stories that have been told before. Every new generation needs them told in a slightly different way as well. For the Greeks, for instance, their mindset was so completely different, so masculine, so frightened of women. All the monsters, pretty nearly, are women in Greek myth. And you have to kind of adapt the story very gently into something that is accessible to a modern reader.
And another way in which books are made accessible to all by the RNIB Library and also by yourself is to have them made into talking or audio books and also Braille and giant print copies. You must be delighted that, well, maybe you don't know, that there is a large number of your books available in all accessible forms from the RNIB Library for blind and visually impaired readers.
I'm delighted. I'm totally delighted. Myself, I love audiobooks because I'm a very slow reader. It takes me ages to read a book. And so I always loved audio, and I think it's... I'm so proud when my books get made into audio, but that's absolutely splendid. I did know about a couple, but I'd be really interested to know how many of my books are available out there.
An awful lot more than you would probably guess, actually. There's quite a big number came up on the search that I did, and as I say, it's in all three accessible formats, which is always lovely to see as well.
I have got a Braille copy somewhere. I do. I carry it round and show it to schools when I visit. It's a thing of beauty. I don't know if it's my... I can't remember whether it's my Carnegie book, but it certainly is one of them that I was sent, because I actually want... I think I asked for it because I wanted to show the various different ways of accessing a story.
Geraldine McCorkerin, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you.
Thanks to Geraldine McCorkerin. Like all the books on the Cillit Carnegie shortlist, Where the World Ends is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library, where you'll also find many more of Geraldine's brilliant books for children and young adults. Visit rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999 and select option 5.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, Ruta Sepetys takes us back to World War II. But before that... Up till now, Will Hill has been best known as the author of the Department 19 series of novels for young adults. In them, his teenage hero battles vampires and demons to prevent them taking over England. But for his latest novel, After the Fire, Will has turned his attention to a real-life monster in the Texas desert, as he told me when he joined me down the line. So, After the Fire was inspired by real events, I believe.
It was. It was inspired by the siege of the Branch Davidian compound in Texas in 1993. It became known as the Waco Siege because that was the town that it was close by. That was a confrontation between the American federal authorities and a religious community headed by a man called David Koresh. That became a siege after they attempted to serve a warrant, and was across the course of a summer a massive standoff that ultimately ended in the deaths of 80 or so people, members of the commune and people who worked for the agencies as well, and became this real flashpoint moment, I think, in American history. I recall seeing it on the news in the UK, and I suspect it didn't make the same impact everywhere else in the world, but it became a very kind of important moment in American history about religion and firearms and the roles of the American government and what they could and couldn't do. And then it sort of faded away, as these things do. I remember seeing and reading about it at the time, but then it was sort of gone, the way these things always tend to. It came back sort of 15 years later or so, when I was in Washington on holiday, I saw an exhibit about the FBI in the press at a museum there, and the images kind of are very iconic. They're these images of what looked like tanks rolling across the desert with these buildings burning in the background, and it all kind of came flooding back to me. And I'd been interested in cults pretty much my whole life, as so many people are, and this just brought this one particularly back to me, and I started thinking that there was a story there that I might want to tell.
What do you think that the fascination with cults is? Because it certainly is a bit of a trope in fiction and in life in general, really.
I've thought about this a lot because I was trying to interrogate why I was fascinated in them myself. I think there's a couple of things. I think the secretive nature of them, I think, just makes them automatically intriguing, because there's always the sense that there's something or some things going on inside these groups that the rest of the world sort of isn't allowed to see. And I think that's sort of inherently interesting on the grounds that I think people are fundamentally nosy. I think the thing I've come back to time and again, I think, is that I think people find them fascinating because I think people try to put themselves into the positions of people who join these groups or end up inside these groups. And I think that is challenging for a lot of people. I think one of the things I thought a lot about when I was writing After the Fire was that I think when these things end badly, as they often do in the case of Waco or Jonestown or Heaven's Gate, etc., the tendency is for the first question, I think, to be, you know, for people to ask how did this happen, and then, you know, how did people fall for this, which is a perfectly sort of legitimate question, but I always thought was one that wasn't as simple as perhaps it seems, because you read about what these cults' beliefs are or what their structures are or how they operate, and they seem just sort of so incomprehensible. And the notion that, you know, one person is almost always a man has this incredible authority over a group of people where they will do what they're told and live a certain way and obey kind of all these rules that are seemingly arbitrary, that I think there's a tendency for people to think that these people must have been, you know, stupid or weak or vulnerable, and I think there's often a lot more to it than that. In the case of something like Waco, and that I took very much for After the Fire, these things tend not to start out as kind of extreme or strange as they end up. They tend to gradually turn that way over a period of time, over a long process of kind of manipulation and abuse, bluntly. And I think by the time things have got as bad as they often get, I think people, I'm sure there are people inside them who are wondering, how did it come to this? But by that point, it can be very hard to leave, or it can be that you are not able to leave. And I thought that really was the something I wanted to have a kind of real look at, because I wanted to show, I guess, that these people are not all crazy or fanatical or, you know, in some way kind of bad or mean, that a lot of them would be normal people just trying to survive.
The book is a forensic unpicking of the very question that Moonbeam asks at the beginning. I need to understand how it came to this. And as you say, you show that it's a journey made in little steps all going in one direction, which is to deny the other cult members access to the outside world.
Absolutely. The insular nature of these cults is pretty much always a central tenet of how they operate, and that I think it probably stands to reason that if you, over a period of time, as you say, if you gradually paint everyone who is not a member of the organization that you are a member of as bad or dangerous or wicked or sinful or whichever terminology they choose to use, then you kind of bring the people who are standing against that, the people who are inside this organization, I mean, obviously that brings them together. It gives them a kind of shared purpose. It gives them a sense of that they have to look out for each other. They have to stand together against all the threats and all the dangers that are outside. But also, once you start to create that situation, and once that starts to be the belief that you instill into people, then also, I think then it becomes easier for whoever is in charge to start to say, you know, you have to trust me, fundamentally. You have to do what I say. I have all of our best interests at heart. I am the person who is going to make sure that we are okay. And I think on a long enough timeline, that sense of constant pressure of constantly being under threat, of being in danger, I think it eventually makes that seem like a plausible solution, that eventually you do go, we have to trust him. We are where we are now, and this is the world, and this is what we're facing. And I think over a long enough period of time, as you start to deny people the ability to research for themselves or look at things objectively for themselves, then you can end up in these situations where, unfortunately, terrible things can happen.
Well, yes, it's the Father John is the cult leader. Father John's prophecy of the apocalypse does actually come true.
It does. I mean, that's the sort of terrifying thing. And it comes true in no small part because he makes sure that it does. And that obviously is also often a central feature of these cults, and particularly of the way that they end. It's often a self-fulfilling prophecy where you behave, or you create a situation in which eventually the time will come that the people you have been warning the rest of your group about will eventually take an interest in you and potentially in some way come for you. And then you get to say, I told you this would happen. This was always coming. Now we have to kind of stand against this threat that I always said was there. The research that I took, I think, probably most inspiration from was the work of a psychiatrist called Perry, Dr. Bruce Perry, and he worked with children who were released partway through the Waco siege. And he was attempting to deal with the enormous amounts of stress and trauma that they had been through. And he said one of the most challenging things was they had been told that the outsiders, or the Babylonians, as David Koresh called them, meant them nothing but harm, that they would kill them all if they got the chance. And these children were making some amount of progress, but then when the cult ended, when the siege ended, and when so many of their kind of parents and older brothers and sisters died, that was, as you say, that was monumentally difficult, because it was then very difficult for them to try to tell these children that, you know, Koresh had been lying to them, that what he was prophesizing wasn't going to happen, because it happened right in front of them.
The other question that I felt resonated throughout the book was, how do you rebuild your life, especially if you're a child with your life ahead of you? How do you rebuild your life after something that terrible and damaging has happened?
Absolutely. I mean, that really is the central question of the whole novel, because it's the question that Moonbeam, who is the main character, who's the whole book is from her POV, so we spend the entirety of the book inside her head. That is the challenge that she is now facing, having survived the end of the Lord's Legion, and now is looking at what the rest of her life will potentially contain. And she has challenges herself in that she is very worried about things that she believes that she did and things that she knows, and she is not entirely confident that she is going to get to have anything like a normal life. The book is set in two time zones, and the second one is inside a secure hospital while she's being treated by a psychiatrist and being questioned by an FBI agent. And she is not at all sure that she will ever get out of there. She believes, for various reasons, that she may be forced to stay there. But her concern primarily is for the other children who survived, and particularly the younger ones, who she is desperately hopeful might be able to still move on from this. She's not sure of it at all, but she is hopeful that now Father John's influence has been removed and the walls, essentially, that kept the rest of the world out have been brought down. She is very hopeful that these children may have the chance to build a life, but she's under no illusions about how difficult it's going to be. She's seen how deep the hooks go that Father John put into them, how deep the indoctrination is, and it's an enormous challenge for all of them. It's a case of they have obviously enormous practical challenges, in the sense that there is huge amounts of the outside world that they just simply don't understand, that they haven't seen in terms of just day-to-day life, but also they have the poison, essentially, that Father John dripped into their ears that is going to stay there forever. Throughout the book, Moonbeam still has Father John's voice in her head all the way through, as much as she has come to hate him by the time of the start of the story, and as much as her faith has failed her to some extent, he's still there, and she wonders several times during the course of the book whether she'll ever actually be rid of him.
It's very telling that actually one of the first things she's given after medical attention is pen and paper, and then gradually access to books as well. It's a reintroduction of the outside world into her world, and also another point of view that she can get other than Father John's exclusive belief only in the way that he sees the world.
Absolutely, and it seems like such a small thing, but she and it is a sort of core tenet of various aspects of therapy, of dealing with younger children, and particularly those who have suffered trauma, of letting them draw and express themselves. And for Moon Moon, it carries a certain amount of significance because it was something that she liked to do, that over the course of the years was gradually one of the many small, seemingly petty things that was outlawed by Father John for no real reasons, and all the other and the books were taken away, and everything was gradually stripped away until all that was left was his kind of ideology. And so it marks a very small return to something that she remembers from a time before everything got as bad as it was. There's a line in there where she's drawing on a piece of paper, and she's talking about it being new, and it being a flat sort of brand new clean sheet of paper, and it feels very strange to her because she kept a kind of little notebook that she'd drawn over a million times, because that was a thing that she kept hidden from everyone else and couldn't get a new one of. And just the sort of the strange kind of simplicity of just having fresh paper and having new clothes for the first time ever are just immediately show you, I think, quite how different this world is going to be for her now.
It's a remarkably compelling story, and it's told very pacily. It felt to me as a reader that it spilled out of you, that it had been ready to come out. Did it write that way?
It did. It was a very complicated book to finish in a way, in the sense that it has a it seems like quite a simple structure. It has before and after alternating chapters that, you know, are before the fire and then after it, and that is not in itself incredibly complicated. But the storyline in terms of what she knows and what she's trying to keep secret, and her as a sort of unreliable narrator, as she's trying to work out for herself whether or not she can trust these people to tell her the truth, all took a lot of juggling and fiddling around towards the end. But the actual core tenet of the central story, of which probably 90% of it is still what ended up making up the final book, all did come out extremely quickly. It was, I kind of had this very, you know, damaged but very courageous girl who I kind of instantly understood who she was and what she had been through and what her kind of ambitions for the future were. And the research that was done later to make the cult hopefully feel plausible and feel realistic, and that was sort of, to a certain extent, was window dressing at the end to make sure that everything was as tight and as realistic as it could be. The actual story of her trying to come to terms with what has happened and trying to come to terms with the prospect of a future was written in about maybe a kind of 6-8 week period, where it did, as you say, it sort of just flew out, and then it took maybe another 6 months to finesse it to the point that it was ready for anyone to read. But it was it was quite a sort of cathartic experience. I think it did just seem to just exist quite quickly.
Will Hill, thank you for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you so much.
Thanks to Will Hill. After the Fire is TB702513, and it's also available in Braille and giant print on demand from the RNIB library. Alongside it, you can also find Department 19, narrated by Jot Davis, which is TB700265.
Talking Books.
In the Talking Books library.
They found her, my lord! Ned rose quickly. Omen or Lannisters? It was Jory. Daenerys Targaryen wed Khal Drogo with fear and barbaric splendor in a field beyond the walls of Pentos. The North went on forever. Tyrion Lannister knew the maps as well as anyone. But a fortnight on the wild track that passed for the King's Road up here had brought home the lesson that the map was one thing and the land quite another.
Game of Thrones by George R.R. Martin. Book 1 in A Song of Ice and Fire.
The courtyard rang to the sound of swords. Under black wool, boiled leather, and mail, sweat trickled icily down John's chest as he pressed the attack.
Narrated by Tom Carter, it lasts 35 hours and 2 minutes. Talking book number 19231.
Tell Jory to bring her here at once. I am sorry, my lord, Poole told him. The guards on the gate were Lannister men, and they informed the queen when Jory brought her in. She's been taken directly before the king.
Also available are A Clash of Kings, A Storm of Swords, A Feast for Crows, and A Dance with Dragons. And many of them you can buy as a Daisy CD. For more information, head to www.rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
The Silip Carnegie Medal recognises the best books for children and young adults published each year in the English language. It attracts entries from English-speaking countries around the world. And last year's winner was Lithuanian-American author Ruta Sepetys. Her book, Salt to the Sea, reimagines a maritime tragedy that occurred towards the end of World War II. She joined me down the line from her home in Nashville, Tennessee. Many, many congratulations on winning the Carnegie Medal. How do you feel?
It's indescribable. It's a tremendous honor. And I joked with my family that I'm still waiting for the phone call that someone will tell me, oh, we're so sorry. There's been an error. But no, truly, it's incredible, especially for historical fiction. I'm so happy.
It's a wonderful achievement. It's a wonderful book. I know one of the things that you are given as well as the medal is a Braille copy of the book as well. Had you ever had a Braille copy of a book before?
No, I have never had a Braille edition of any of my books, and I'm so thrilled. It's going to sit on my bookshelf right behind my desk.
One of the lovely things about the Carnegie Medal is that the organisers have a long-standing agreement with the Royal National Institute for Blind People in the UK that provides accessible copies of all the shortlisted entries to RNIB members so that we can listen along or read in Braille along with the judges to judge who should be the winner. So presumably as an author, you're delighted to reach a wider audience.
I am, absolutely. And not because I wrote the books, but because of the history that my novels represent. Many of the people that I'm writing about believe that the world has forgotten them or that these pieces of history have slipped through the cracks. And so, yes, I'm anxious for the books and the associated history to reach as large an audience as possible.
You certainly give names and identities to the statistics. Would you like to tell the listeners a little bit about the real-life story behind Salt to the Sea?
Yes, definitely. Salt to the Sea is set in winter of 1945, and at this point, World War II was coming to an end, and Hitler knew that it did not look very positive for Germany. However, he forbid people to evacuate. He felt that if he allowed civilians to evacuate, it would affect morale. And so it became a very dire situation. And when evacuation orders were issued, for many, it was already too late. And millions of people pushed toward the port because that was the only place to escape. It was over water. And there was this massive refugee evacuation that some of my own family members were part of. And one of the ships commandeered for the evacuation was an old German cruise ship called the Wilhelm Gustloff. And the Gustloff held about 1,400 people, but when it sailed amidst a snowstorm on January 30th, 1945, it was carrying over 10,000 people. And it was torpedoed by a Soviet submarine, and it sank in less than 60 minutes, and over 9,000 people lost their lives, including over 5,000 children. And it's the single largest maritime disaster in history, but most people have never heard of it.
I certainly had never heard of it before reading your book, and
I think one of the things that really came through about the book is just how varied the nationalities of the people involved in the disaster were, and that, well, no single group either has a monopoly on the tragedy or actually is totally blameless as far as the war going on around them is concerned. It's only the children who are the innocents, really.
That's exactly right. And I traveled to 6 different countries researching the book. And what made an impression on me is that human beings can experience the same event, but have a drastically different interpretation of it. And of course, based on their culture or the lens that they're looking through. And that's what inspired me to create these 4 different characters. And to your point, yes, there is much shared responsibility, and suffering truly emerged the victor of the war. And because my father was a child at this time, you know, that's always led me to wonder, what would it be like for the children, for these innocent victims of war and vengeful regimes, who were then left with an inheritance and a responsibility for something that they had no role in causing? And that's what led me to focus on the story of the young people in Salt to the Sea.
And yet they also provide the hope.
They do. And that was another lesson that I learned from survivors and even family members of victims. They were sharing these lessons, such as that, you know, we don't choose our hardships, but we can choose how we face our hardships. And many of the people I spoke to, they wanted me to include elements of hope in the novel because they explained that it did exist. And for many people, that's what saved their lives.
It's an intensely moving book. And I know in the afterword, you talk about having been fortunate enough to talk to survivors and read their accounts. Presumably an enormous amount of research went into this book. How do you know when to stop researching and start writing?
If I had it my way, I would never stop. I would never stop the research process. And even after the book is published, more information, you know, keeps coming, which is so exciting. But for me, when I begin to hear similar stories over and over, or if I come upon information that I've already been over many times, then I know, okay, let's stop with the research. And I try to write and research at the same time because I feel that if I can write as I am learning and researching the novel, perhaps the text will have an emotional immediacy, because certainly when I'm interviewing people and when I'm learning of their experience, it's very emotionally charged. And sometimes I fear that if I separate the research and the writing, that I'll lose a bit of that emotional pacing.
It's a great gift to enable your readers to empathize with people that they have never met. And, you know, in my case, actually, at one point, reduced me to tears because of the tragedy. I suppose knowing that you've done the research and felt those emotions yourself, that's the way you managed to channel it into your writing.
Yes, I try. And also, this is an advantage that I'm afforded through fiction versus nonfiction. If I were to tell the story through nonfiction, perhaps I would follow the thread of one family, of one person. But with fiction, I can interview 100 people and weave pieces of different stories together into one character, with the goal being to create a character that you care about. And when I say care about, either meaning love or hate, because if you don't like a character, you will also follow them to the end to see what happens to them. But if I can create characters that feel human, you'll follow them for 300 pages, holding, you know, their hand and feeling their fear. And that's when a statistic becomes a human being. And when our heart opens and we feel this connection and we feel compelled to do something or to tell someone, or maybe we're emotionally moved. So with historical fiction, my creativity comes in the character development.
I love the anti-hero that you've created in Alfred. I think, you know, everybody knows an Alfred, and he is in exactly the right position in the book.
It's true. And for me, Alfred is also a study of visibility. What happens to a young boy who becomes a young man who's basically been rejected his entire life? He's been invisible, and suddenly he's given a uniform and he becomes very visible, if only in his own mind. And to create the character of Alfred, I studied Adolf Hitler as a teen. As a teenager, Hitler composed these letters to a girl named Stephanie, and they were so inflated, almost, it could be argued, delusional, but he never mailed these letters. But we saw a glimpse of Hitler and as a young boy and how he thought and felt about himself and his future. And so that was one of my techniques for creating Alfred.
Fascinating. Yes, well, one wonders what he might have become. And also, you have a blind character in the book as well. Where did the inspiration for Ingrid come from?
When I was interviewing refugees, they were explaining the dire situation at the train stations, that there were so many people looking to board these trains that people were being left behind. And a woman told me that she remembered being on a train and pushed toward the window, seeing a young blind woman all alone on the platform, calling out, and she was all alone. And that absolutely moved me. And I thought so much. And of course, I was asking so many questions of the woman. I said, well, what did you know? And did someone get off the train? And did someone help her? And I said, she said, I don't know. Mm. So I just felt so compelled, you know, to include that in the novel.
And of course, the blind and the otherwise disabled were viewed as garbage for disinfection by Hitler and the Nazis.
Yes, and I include that in the novel, that Alfred is referring to, that there are termed garbage children, life unworthy of life. And that's something that when I do school visits, young readers, that's probably the first thing that they call out. And one of the many reasons that I'm so honored to write for young readers, they have such a sense of justice, and they're truly moved to make a difference, and they have so much energy. And that has been something that young readers have repeatedly referenced in the book.
You write about some pretty hard-hitting facts of war, and I know in your other two novels about totalitarianism and also about brothels. Do you think there is a line beyond which one shouldn't stray in young adult fiction? Or do you think children should be exposed to all the horrors of the adult world?
I don't think there is a line that should be drawn. What I do as a writer, I challenge myself to describe things in a way that if these things are within the reader's consciousness at the age when they read the book, that they will absorb what's going on. But perhaps if not, that they won't. And so I challenge myself that way, and certainly try not to be gratuitous. But also, I respect the fact that, you know, parents, I admire parents who are involved with what their children are reading. And if they don't feel it's appropriate, I completely respect that. But my experience has been that young readers have a very profound sense of emotional truth. They feel things very deeply. And so books that we read at 12, 13, 14, they have the ability to make an impression on us, a lasting impression. I think everyone listening can remember a book that they read when they were young. Those books stay with us. And so if I can share information about these underrepresented parts of history and put them into the caring and gentle hands of young readers, that would make me so happy. But yes, I do try to challenge myself to do it in a careful and responsible way.
And I certainly think you succeed. I think also, you know, there are warnings from history that need to be heeded in an age where refugees are fleeing across the Mediterranean. It's quite pertinent to remember that 80 years ago, refugees were fleeing across Europe. You mention Ukraine a few times in the book, and obviously Ukraine, again, is subject to invasion by Russia. Was that in your mind when you were writing the book?
Well, it's always been in my mind because I'm the daughter of a refugee, and 77 years ago, that refugee child was my father. So, my father fled from Lithuania when the Soviets occupied and wasn't able to return to Lithuania for 50 years. So, yes, it's always on my mind, as is the plight of the children. Like I said, these innocent victims. So, yes, Ukraine is always on my mind and in my heart.
And again, from the afterword, you say that this is really the research of the book was really a global collaborative effort, that it is through researching historical documents, talking to people and reading accounts from the past, that actually you create a global community of readers who might not make the same mistakes again. You clearly feel that very strongly.
I do. And I know that for many, writing is a solitary endeavor, and researching is as well. But for me, it's a bit of a team sport. I had a tremendous research partner, Klaus Petersen in Denmark, who helped me quite a bit. And several of the divers, the deep sea divers that had explored the sunken Guslof, they helped enormously. I am not a diver myself and could, now it's also illegal to explore the sunken ship. But there were two Polish divers that had explored the ship quite early on. They're elderly men now. And they spent several days with me, not only explaining about the tragedy and what they experienced in the Baltic Sea, but together we also walked the path of the refugees. And granted, I was walking in spring, and it was a difficult walk, and I couldn't fathom what it would be like to walk in the dead of winter. And I would never have had access to that kind of experience without these people. And they played such a large role. And even there's an author, a writer, Catherine Prince. She's a writer and journalist, and she had written a nonfiction book on the Guslof called Death in the Baltic. And she so generously shared her research with me and some of her contacts. And so I'm so grateful. I think it really brought an extra dimension to the novel.
Well, it is a fantastic achievement, an amazingly moving read. Thank you so much for sharing some insights into Salt to the Sea, and many, many congratulations again.
Thank you so, so much. I truly appreciate it. An author has nothing without readers.
Like all the books shortlisted for the Philip Carnegie Medal, Salt to the Sea is available from the RNIB Library in a full range of accessible formats.
It may shock many people to know that in the UK, another 100 people start to lose their sight every day. Now, sight loss can happen to anyone at any time, and the RNIB is there to provide support when it does happen.
Frederick Forsyth on supporting Talking Books.
Talking Books is described as one of the RNIB's most important services. To find out more about Talking Books or to support the RNIB campaign, call 0845 345 0054 or visit www.rnib.org.uk.
Get all the latest news and more for people with sight loss by connecting with RNIB on Facebook and Twitter. Support us on social media for all sorts of extras. And it's a great way of networking with like-minded people. Search for RNIB on Facebook and follow us now on @RNIB. Follow us and find out more about the UK's leading sight loss charity and feel part of the RNIB family.
Now it's back to Geraldine McCorkerin for the books of her life. So was there a book that you read as a child or a young adult that made you fall in love with reading and want to become a writer?
I got into Rosemary Sutcliffe. And Rosemary Sutcliffe, who is all historical novels, I soaked her up like the morning dew, I really did, because it took me back to the past and I could feel myself become the hero of each of the books. And I won as a school prize one of the Rosemary Sutcliffe books. Though Eagle of the Ninth, I think, is still probably the very best.
From the Fossway westward to Isca Damnoniorum, the road was simply a British trackway, broadened and roughly metalled, strengthened by corduroys of logs in the softest places, but otherwise unchanged from its old estate, as it wound along among the hills, thrusting farther and farther into the wilderness. It was a busy road, and saw many travellers. Traders with bronze weapons and raw yellow amber in their ponies' packs, country folk driving shaggy cattle or lean pigs from village to village, sometimes a band of tawny-haired tribesmen from further west, strolling harpers and quack oculists too, or a light-stepping hunter with huge wolfhounds at his heel. And from time to time, a commissariat wagon going up and down to supply the Roman frontier post. The road saw them all, and the cohorts of the Eagles, for whom all other travellers must make way.
Rosemary Sutcliffe's The Eagle of the Ninth is available in Braille, giant print, and in the trilogy Three Legions, which is TB 3908, and it's narrated by George Hagen.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Music and Silence by Rose Tremain. It's an absolutely beautiful example of world creation. It's about a musician that's employed as an entertainer, and there's hardly anything you could say about it that wouldn't be a spoiler. but it's so music is quite important to me, and I use music quite a lot to create mood when I'm writing. You can always find a composer that suits every book, and the love, the inherent love in Music and Silence for music is so special. Also, I'm going deaf, so the idea of going deaf and not having the access to music is just so terrible to me that book I feel very much for the young musician.
Until this moment, when the flame of the lamp flares blue, then settles to steady yellow inside its ornate globe, the young man had been impressed by the profound darkness into which, upon his late-night arrival at the palace of Rosenborg, he had suddenly stepped. Tired from his long sea journey, his eyes stinging, his walk unsteady, he had been questioning the nature of this darkness. For it seemed to him not merely an external phenomenon having to do with an actual absence of light, but rather as though it emanated from within him, as if he had finally crossed the threshold of his own absence of hope.
Music and Silence by Rose Tremain is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB 15423, and it's narrated by Jenny Agata. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Yes, it's Francis Spufford, Golden Hill. Got a great deal of coverage because so many authors had waited such a long time for Francis Buffer to write fiction. He's always written non-fiction, and he has the most beautiful style I have read anywhere. His description in I May Be Some Time of Titus Oates going out into the storm, of the whole trip of Captain Scott to the Antarctic, is so beautiful that it just made my heart pound. And I longed for him to write some fiction. And sure enough, he came up with Golden Hill, which if you just got the bravery to get through the first chapter and get into the weird construction of the sentences there, it's fabulous. It makes fabulous reading. And it's such a good plot. Not only can he write beautiful prose, he writes such a good, exciting plot.
The brig Henrietta, having made Sandy Hook a little before the dinner hour, and having passed the Narrows about 3 o'clock, and then crawling to and fro in a series of tacks infinitesimal enough to rival the calculus across the grey sheet of the harbour of New York, until it seemed to Mr. Smith, dancing from foot to foot upon deck, that the small mound of the city waiting there would hover ahead in the November gloom in perpetuity, never growing closer to the smirk of Greek Zeno. And the day being advanced to dusk by the time Henrietta at last lay anchored off Tichy's Slip, and the veritable gables of the city's veritable houses divided from him only by 100 foot of water, and the dusk moreover being as cold and damp and dim as November can afford, as if all the world were a quarto of grey paper dampened by drizzle, until in danger of crumbling imminently to pap. All this being true, the master of the brig pressed upon him the virtue of sleeping this one further night aboard, and pursuing his shore business in the morning. He, meaning by the offer to signal his esteem, having found Mr. Smith a pleasant companion during the slow weeks of the crossing. But Mr. Smith would not have it. Smith, bowing and smiling, desired nothing but to be rowed to the dock.
Thomas Hodgkins narrating Golden Hill by Francis Spufford, which is TB 23815. Geraldine McGaughran, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you.
Don't forget, you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, packed with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or you can find producer Robert on Twitter @talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.